Coming up on this week's book show, acclaimed author Courtney Malm's latest, Costa Alegre, is the striking, heartbreaking, and strange story of a privileged teenager who has everything a girl could wish for, except for a mother who loves her back. The book is heavily inspired by the real-life relationship between the heiress Peggy Guggenheim and her daughter. Courtney Malm, on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Courtney Malm is the author of Touch, as well as the acclaimed I Am Having So Much Fun Here Without You. Her latest is the striking, heartbreaking, and yes, strange, Costa Alegre. Heavily inspired by the real-life relationship between the heiress, Peggy Guggenheim, and her daughter. Malm tells the imaginative and curiously touching story of a privileged teenager who has everything a girl could wish for, except for a mother who loves her back. Costa Alegre is the name of the new novel, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Courtney Malm back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you here again on the program.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Briefly, tell us the inspiration. This is Peggy Guggenheim and her daughter, and at what point did this pop into your radar and say, oh, that's something I could work with?
Right. So I was researching the Guggenheim, specifically Peggy Guggenheim, for another project which didn't come to fruition, mostly because as I was reading Guggenheim's memoirs, I started seeing this erasure of her daughter, her real-life daughter, Peggy, that I couldn't ignore. And it's not that Peggy wasn't in Peggy's memoirs. It's not that she denied having a daughter. It's just that she didn't seem to ascribe any importance to this person's existence. And Peggy Guggenheim was someone who wanted to be an artist in her own right. So that erasure seemed even more poignant. So then I sort of spun out and tried to look at the people in Guggenheim's circle, how they spoke about Peggy, and she just wasn't there. But she was there. She existed during a period of time in American history that's incredibly important and sad. We're talking about right before World War II, when Peggy Guggenheim, along with Varian, the American journalist, Varian Frey, and the Emergency Rescue Committee, was helping important artists and intellectuals get out of Europe. And so Peggy Guggenheim would have been quite young, moving from country to country with the world's most celebrated artists, had her education halted, is trying to be a painter herself and is not really getting attention from her mother. So the question that I ultimately had to respond to in a novel was, what would it feel like to have modern art as a rival for your mother's love?
The story that you tell is written from the vantage point of Lara, who is the daughter, 15 years old. She is a remarkably reliable narrator.
You think so?
Well, I think she knows more what's going on than the rest of the cast, don't you?
I would definitely say so. I mean, she's really in a sort of crumbling castle with a bunch of surrealists, so you don't know who to trust. And the book is written in a diary format. So for most of the time, I think she's being quite honest with her feelings. There's a couple of sections in the diary where she tries out different flourishes of a different writerly style, or
right.
There's pictures, you know, she's doing drawings, but I think, yes, she's a reliable witness to what is taking place.
And for 15, and I know that can go either way, but
yeah.
But she seems to have a pretty good sense. She feels that, yeah, her mother really never wanted a daughter.
unfortunately, it's very sad to speak about, and I feel badly sometimes speaking about these people who can't defend themselves. But again, I mean, in the memoirs, Peggy's own words, she did say that she didn't think that she was a very good mother and maybe wasn't cut out for it. The time in which she lived, this was what women did. And even though she was an iconoclast, she did have children.
So in the novel, she has two children. She has a son who is away, and then, of course, the daughter who is telling the story. Tell us a little bit about why you chose to make this a fictional account and to make these characters your own.
I guess for starters, I decided to make it a fictional account because there weren't any non-fictional accounts about Pagin or from Pagin's point of view. I couldn't find diaries. That being said, I'll admit that I didn't try too hard because I really wanted to run. Once I had my Laura's voice in my mind, I wanted to run with it and not be too influenced by other things. But still, I really looked and I just couldn't find anything about this young woman who ended up having a pretty tragic life. I also think that the response of artists right before something catastrophic, like a world war or another international trauma, these cultural responses, I think, are worthy of exploration, revisitation, and I feel that way today. And so looking into the way that the artists who had, most of them, if they were lucky enough to get out of Europe, they did have to flee Europe. Hitler was interning who he considered cultural degenerates to be. I thought that, I mean, this is a period of time that was worthy of my attention.
1937, and as you mentioned, Hitler is circulating a most wanted list of these cultural degenerates. So these are writers and thinkers and artists whose work is deemed antithetical to the new regime. So to prevent the destruction of the art, Peggy, and in your case,
Leonora Calloway.
Leonora Calloway brings the artists onto a boat and brings them to Costa Rica.
So the VIPs actually get to come in an airplane.
Yes.
And the VIPs are whom we spend time with, because the other ones, the sort of the B-list artists, they are coming in a boat. And one of the main drivers of the book is that they just have no idea whether this boat, which has human artists on it, but also Laura's inheritance and the entire collection that Leonora Calloway has been spending her whole life gathering is also on that boat.
There's a beautiful scene in the novel where Laura is in the plane looking down, thinking that any ship she sees, she can sort of follow them as she goes.
Right, exactly. I mean, and you know, this ship is also, this was true. Peggy Guggenheim did have to send the art and some artists on a ship, and it became something of an in-joke in her circle where people would tease her and say, oh, we heard it sunk. And this information couldn't be verified right away. You know, we're not in the digital age, obviously. And that was very interesting to me. I really wanted to isolate these characters. So in real life, most of them would have been shepherded to New York. I brought them to Western Mexico because I wanted to cut them off even more deeply from communication channels. So they not only do they not know about the boat and the other artists, but they also don't know whether war has arrived.
And they keep waiting for that news. Anyone who arrives, anything that arrives, they're hoping will bring them news of the war.
Exactly. Or anyone who leaves. Sometimes they don't return. So, you know, you have sort of a waiting for Godot situation.
Also, this is a return for her, because this is a place, Costa Alegre, where they have been before.
Where some of them have been before. It's a place where Leonora has a home. But it's been about 7 years since Laura was last there. And now she's a 15-year-old young woman who has developed a passion for art, you know, within herself. So things are different. She's not a young girl anymore.
There's a section in the book where, and as you said, it's written in diary entry, where Laura is saying that her art has never really been appreciated, that she's drawing, but no one has ever remark that she has this talent, this base skill.
Right, right. People will say, you know, if her work is noticed at all, and, you know, she is, of course, in Costa Alegre, she's housed with all these other artists, but that's been her life for a while, is that her mother always has these sort of artistic foster children or adult foster children in her home. And so, of course, she's yearning for some stamp of approval from the great, great artists of the time. And she, not only has she never received it, but no one has really said to her, oh, you have a gift, or even you have a talent. She feels completely unnoticed. And of course, as you do as a young person coming into your own passion, she's just yearning for someone to say, hey, you have a shot at this.
Courtney Mom's new novel is Costa Alegre. It is published by Tin House. Give us a sense of the people that they are in Costa Alegre with. I would call them oddballs, right? A very eccentric,
very
surrealist.
Very eccentric. I mean, you have within the VIPs, you know, you have some conceptual artists. You have Dadaists who that was pre-World War One movement, anti-establishment, anti-capitalism. So you have people playing, basically spoken word performers who are playing with the mixture of the visual and the verbal. You have writers. You have a kind of Salvador Dali character who goes everywhere with a velvet cape and only eats shellfish that other people have to peel for him. You have a mute rock collector who's based on a real artist named Ferdinand Chaval, who died of insomnia because he built a castle out of rocks that he collected on his postal route. I mean, yes, you have oddballs. That is, we could definitely call them oddballs. No children. There's no young people. Lara is the only young person.
There's also a lot of nudity, weirdly.
Lots of nudity.
I mean, that seems to be the party game, that eventually people get naked.
I mean, this was something I read in my research, that, you know, the surrealist artist and writer Leonora Carrington used to go to parties completely naked with mustard painted on her feet. I don't know how you get around with mustard on your feet, but it did seem to me that they were having some pretty wild evenings, so I wanted to incorporate that.
And in their world, it makes sense, right? But it... Thank God for a 15-year-old who's the leveler,
right.
Who goes,
it's not making so much sense. And she, of course, is in a very difficult position because she's mature enough to recognize that her mother is dispensing with a great deal of money in order to protect these people, and that these people need her mother's money and yet are not always showing a lot of respect towards her mother. So there's some power dynamics in the book that must have been, I imagine, would have been really difficult for a young person to witness.
There are some what I would call typical diary entries or chapters, if you will, and then things that are just lists. What I'm not happy about, what I'm happy about. I also love that they start with the not happy.
Like, right.
Let's start
of
with
course.
The negative. This
She's
is what
15.
We.
I mean, yeah.
Right. This is what I don't like. And she has her father, and then her what would be her stepfather, right? That she refers to as her.
Well, it goes, but she changes sometimes depending on how she feels about it. But usually, he's new father or papa number two.
Yes, and he, that father, already has a mistress and
who has been brought along.
Who has been brought along? Why not? And then also, but she's all. Meaning Lara is aware of all of this.
She's absolutely aware of it, and her real father, and she refers to him as real father, is in Switzerland with her brother, and they've been there forever. And it's not mentioned in the book, but it's been a pretty long estrangement. Her new father, the stepfather, she's aware that her mother married him mostly, you know, to save him and get him out of an internment camp. And he doesn't seem to love her. This is a problem. And is, you know, she's not surrounded by a lot of good, solid relationship examples. That's for sure.
When you look at your story compared to the real story, 1937. So what is the time frame that you wanted to look at specifically? Just that year?
I would say even less. I actually haven't mapped it out exactly, but I mean, it's basically like a 3-month period, 4-month period before. I was really trying to capture the time period where no one yet knew how bad it was going to get. There's a poet I love named Arda Collins, and she has this incredible poem called The News. And the first line is, "At last, terror has arrived." And I was thinking a lot this week about how before you know how bad something's going to get, before bad news hits you and it absorbs you, you understand how it's going to change your life, terror can be a little bit exciting. You know, so I'm trying to capture a period of time where privileged intellectuals were sort of excited about all this danger and mayhem and did not yet understand or could grasp the unthinkable horror that was to come.
Let us talk about the character Jack for a moment and what this character means to Laura when he comes into her life.
So the character of Jack is someone who was a war artist for World War I. And again, this was inspired by fact. They had all male artists who would go to the front lines and paint. And what was happening was a lot of those painters were coming back to their respective countries with these horrific, horrific paintings. And the government was saying, well, we can't show these to people, so you know, you gotta tamper it down. And I was inspired by one British artist in particular named Paul Nash, who was basically told he had to do some sort of propaganda art. He couldn't show dead bodies and he couldn't show dead livestock. So he started using his depiction of the trees to communicate how horrible things were out there in the trenches. So I modeled the character of Jack a little bit on Paul Nash. I wanted him to have a background as a war artist that led him to want to be alone. He's someone who doesn't want to be part of this whole social scene. He actually wants to be left alone and just make his art. He's turned away from painting. He's making sculptures. He's the only person in the book who thinks it's completely inappropriate for Laura to be there. There's no schooling set up for her. She has no schedule whatsoever. Some of these men are predatory. There's no protection. She has no door in her room, you know, and he wants to look out for her. The problem is that Laura's response to him, the way that she's been sort of socialized, is to wonder whether to think of him as an object of you know, affection or a potential sexual mate. Things are very confused for her.
He immediately sees her as someone who's much older.
Yes and no. I mean, I think he sees in her the capability for rational thought, which he sees in no one else. Yes. But he stands up for her a lot vis-a-vis the other people there, saying she shouldn't be here. You need to get her out.
But when he first meets her, he thinks she's, what, 20 or...
Like literal age.
Yes.
Yes, he thinks she's older.
Yes. And then when he learns her age, then the concern kicks in as to what she's gotten herself
into. Right, I think that's an interesting point that I haven't thought about, actually, because I was one of those girls that always looked older than I was up until a certain point, and I do imagine her looking older than she actually is.
The idea of what is going on here, of as you're reading this, you think, well, none of this can end well, right? I mean, just by the virtue of the war, but also just this much chaos, this can't end well.
No, I don't think that it, no. And there's clues in the book, I don't think I'll mention them, that if you're attuned to them, you'll recognize that, no, things are not, things are most probably not going to end very well.
The name of the new novel is Costa Alegre. It is by Courtney Maum, and it is published by Tin House. Let me ask you about what we know of the real life Laura Pagin. So her life, as you mentioned a moment ago, is a fairly tragic one.
It is a tragic one, and I sort of want to interject and say, you know, there is some humor in this book, but...
book is very funny. Once you start writing about goats, man, you got me.
Right,
I'm laughing.
There's a good story about a goat. And I think that's the nice thing about the age at which I decided to jump in and try to tell this story. At 15, there's still hope for this person in many different ways. There's still hope that someone will recognize her art. There's hope that she'll meet someone, whether a platonic friend or a romantic partner, who will really be there for her. But yes, in real life, she followed in her mother's footsteps and had a lot of very disgruntled romances, multiple marriages. She ended up having 4 children, multiple suicide attempts, and she was finally successful at age 42.
42, finally successful.
I mean, finally makes it seem like a positive thing, but yes, yeah, she killed herself.
Yeah. Meaning that up until that point, there had been real
attempts.
Issues and attempts, yes.
Yes, she had a, you know, barbiturate substance abuse problems, some mental health issues. Again, I mean, this is hearsay. This is stuff I read, you know, her ex-husband's saying. But in theory, yes, there were other attempts.
The reason I bring it up is because you can't help but think that this is, in the reading of your novel, you can't help to think of how her early life impacted her.
Exactly. And this is something, I mean, now that I myself am a mother, I'm so moved by the idea of the influence that parents and caretakers can have on their children and offspring, both positive and very, very negative. To me, it makes me so sad to think how easy it is to screw a kid up. And it's certainly not easy to get someone back on track. But, you know, I think about my own childhood. My parents' marriage was unraveling in a way that wasn't super healthy for me to be overhearing and whatnot. And I was very lucky. I had teachers at school who really believed in me and my writing. I had some dear, dear close friends. I had a wonderful, you know, boyfriend. And but kept my head on my shoulders, I think.
One of the things that you realize when I was reading about the real Peggy Guggenheim is that, I mean, even her biographer telling her that, oh, yeah, I slept with 1,000 people when I was in Europe.
Well, right. So I think the first, I forget the exact title, but her memoirs were originally supposed to be titled something like 5 Husbands and a Bunch of Other Men. Again, I'm not trying to slut shame her at all. I actually think it's kind of rad, you know, that she had such a vital sexual life, but I think it's less rad that this was happening in front of young children, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, that was my earlier point, that yes, hey, go for it, but by the same token, you're doing this in front of your daughter, and she is very, very aware, and we see her. I think one of the beautiful blurbs from someone, and I don't know exactly where it is, but talking about how she is, this 15-year-old is the most, is just the smartest person in the room. I mean, understands, is certainly more equipped to take on life than anyone else in this book.
I agree. And I think, I mean, there's, to me, a heartbreaking scene in the book, which again is based off of fact, in which Conrad, her stepfather, who's based on Max Ernst, she's brought in by her mother, who's so excited to see a painting, you know, in which Laura is depicted with just a nightshirt, you know, and no pants on. And she mentions how she has been depicted in his work before. And, you know, should your famous stepfather artist be doing paintings of his stepdaughter totally naked while the woman he's actually married to is covered in awful? Is it awful?
Yeah.
O-F-F-A-N.
Yeah. Awful.
And that painting exists. You know,
yeah.
This was happening. It's recorded that Max Ernst seemed to have a thing for Pagin Guggenheim that was perhaps mutual, but that's a problem.
Yeah, concerning. Mark Eisner is the author says, our 15-year-old narrator is more mature and intuitive than the adult artists who surround her.
For sure. 100%, I think.
Yes, absolutely. I love also the descriptions of the art. There's one, and help me here, but it's an iron, right? Somebody does an iron with just weird nails
so
in it.
Right, so that it's an iron, and there's nails attached to it facing in the direction that you would ruin anything that you try to iron.
Yes, and that was art.
Sure, that's very Dadaist, you know, anti-establishment. Yeah.
And meanwhile, Juarez is trying to figure out, well, why would you do that?
She's surrounded by absurdity at a time where she's feeling very serious about life and love and whether or not she herself is interested in marriage. Certainly at that time, young women would think about marriage. They wouldn't think about, you know, just living with someone. She is coming to terms with her own sexuality and great attractiveness, which is remarked upon far too often by the people in her circles. She's trying to understand whether or not she has a real gift for the one thing that she's passionate about. She is really yearning for female friendship. It's not there. She's feeling sort of serious about things. At the same time, she's a 15-year-old, and then so she does make silly remarks about silly things and is trying to keep some levity in her life. But she's surrounded by people who don't really want to encourage that levity.
And the anchor seems to be the relationship via letter that she has with her brother.
Exactly, except that it's unclear whether these letters were ever sent. It's unclear because it's a diary whether she's sketching these out in her diary and intends to send them. There's no way for her to send letters at that time. In Western Mexico, they keep sending people out to try to understand how they can get letters out or find someone who can send a telegram. But the Mexican people that they send out, because of course, no, there's the only person who speaks Spanish in this book refuses to speak to anyone who he considers beneath him. You're at a complete communication impasse.
Again, these entries that will often seem like chapters, but one will be called altercation, and then the next page it says altercation. So these are kind of how she's thinking about these things.
Right. The way when, you know, if you're not a regular diary keeper, I think people do come to their diary, especially as a young person, and might say something important I don't want to forget. And then they scribble it down.
Right.
And then the next entry might be completely unrelated to the thing before. She might circle back to something that had been written in the past.
There is art in the book. Were you responsible for that?
I was not. I'm very happy to say that my dear friend, the Russian artist Dasha Zibarova, is responsible for that beautiful work. We worked together because, of course, Peggy Guggenheim created art that exists,
yes.
Art that you can see. And I wanted Dasha to come up with art that Lara would have created. So instead of just trying to replicate what Pagin actually created, I would say that Dasha channeled what Pagin as Lara Calloway would have created.
When you finish a book like this, what path does it put you on for the next work?
Well, I will say that I adored my research process for this book, and I'm trying to replicate it for something now because I'm trying to work on an experimental memoir. So the way that I'm gathering facts is replicating the way that I gathered facts for this book. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever be so lucky again to have the kind of writing experience I had with this book, because I did it sort of in private. No one had my agent didn't know what I was working on. I was pretty sure my regular publisher wouldn't be able to publish this. I was able to have that kind of artistic isolation and privacy that Jack has in this book.
Courtney Mom's new novel is Costa Alegre. It is published by Tin House Books. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.